Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, number 173. I'm recording this on Sunday. L.A. is a traffic snarl because of the Oscars. It's bad anyway. And then when they start shutting down streets that are main arteries to get to places, people just lose their fucking minds. Award shows and rain. There's the two things people cannot deal with in Los Angeles just in terms of traffic. Like, if it weren't a Sunday, people would be calling in sick for work. That literally happens. I'm going to call an award show for work today. That absolutely would happen today. But that's all right. I've made it to Nerd Melt. I just got back from Image Expo in Oakland, which was super, super, super fun. I met a lot of cool people at the Walking Dead panel and I'll talk about this in the hostful this week, but I just want to talk about what a great time Image Expo was. But for now, let's focus on the Nerdist business at hand. We are running with lightsabers in hand, screaming at San Diego Comic-Con this year for the 4 days leading up to Comic-Con, July 7th through July 11th. We are going to do Course of the Force, which is a partnership with Machinima and Lucasfilm, and it's basically a lightsaber relay. We're one at a time, quarter-mile segments, passing a lightsaber down the California coast, hopefully in costume. We're going to have parties and music and panels every night along the way, and all of the money from the run segments goes to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. So if you want to purchase that quarter-mile segment, go on to courseoftheforce.com right now and grab those. It's going to be crap loads of fun. Also, we have a bunch of live dates coming up. Jonah and Matt and I are going to be in Boulder, Colorado, March 2nd, then Austin, Texas, March 3rd for two shows. March 23rd in Philadelphia, and I believe we're adding a second show to that. So the first show sold out, so we're adding a second show. Then we're going to be in Atlanta, March 24th, Minneapolis, March 30th. We added a second show to that, too, because the first show sold out. Then Madison, Wisconsin, Chicago, Iowa City, Royal Oak, State College, Pennsylvania, Boston, Massachusetts, May 4th. So all those information for all those dates are at nerdist.com/calendar. I would love to thank, as our returning, our bold new sponsor, Stamps.com. Stamps.com is amazing. I've been using them for years. Super convenient. When I started all the Nerdist stuff early on, I was using Stamps.com to mail stuff. Even going back to when Mike Furman and I were doing Hard and Firm songs, I was using Stamps.com to send out CDs to people because it is an amazing tool if you're a small business. You can print postage on any letter or package whenever you need it 24/7. Then the postman picks it up from your house. You don't ever have to leave. It is the best. If you want to run a small business nude, Stamps.com makes that possible. You also have to have something wrong in your head, but beyond that, they could make that possible. So right now, there's a no-risk trial at Stamps.com. You go on, you get a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage, but only if you use the promo code Nerdist. Why waste your time going to the post office, finding parking, waiting in line? Most people are running small businesses out of their homes right now. You can get out of your bed, walk to your workspace, print out whatever you need to send out, and then just slap some postage on it, and then you're done. That is the pinnacle of productivity without having to get in traffic today, which is normally a horrible experience in Los Angeles. I assume it's not great wherever you live traffic-wise. So Stamps.com, 100%, I recommend these guys. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and then type in Nerdist. That is Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Now, this episode, we were super blown away to get a phone call asking if we wanted Willem Dafoe on the podcast. I was like, what? This is the Nerdist Podcast. Are you sure you got the right number? And they're like, yeah, Willem Dafoe. And we're like, the Willem Dafoe. And they're like, how many Willem Dafoes do you think there are? I'm like, I don't know. Do you have a phone book? There must be like 8 or 10 in the greater Los Angeles area. There is one Willem Dafoe, and he came on our podcast, and he was every bit as amazing as I had hoped he would be. Super cool, had lots of amazing stories, really opened up about his work and his career. I'd also like to say that John Carter, the movie that he's in, that he's currently promoting, is opening March 9th in theaters, which, of course, is the imagining of the Edgar Rice Burroughs stories. So I really enjoyed this episode. Matt had to work. Jonah was there. And we just went and talked to Willem Dafoe. And we both left, and Jonah and I were kind of speechless. Like, he was amazing. That was Willem Dafoe. So if you ever get a chance to have a Willem Dafoe in your life, I totally recommend it. Here it is, the Nerdist Podcast episode number 173. Willem Dafoe!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Good. Jonah, you sound good.
It's funny you say that because I was just to see what you guys were about. I was just listening to some podcasts.
Oh, you were?
And one of them was Patrick Stewart talking about how he fell asleep on the set
of Star Trek. Oh, my God. He was, you know, when I first started the podcast, it was just a bunch of friends and people that I knew. And then as it started to branch out, I was like, oh, no, I'm going to get Patrick. And I don't know him. And,
yeah, sure.
And he was so unbelievably sweet.
Good.
And
good.
Just a nice guy. Have you ever worked with Patrick?
I haven't.
Can we... We're going to make that happen then. Are you announcing now you're going to work with Patrick Stewart? Hollywood Reporter. Willem Dafoe demands to work with Sir Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, that's the way it works.
Yeah, that's what you just said. And it happens, yeah.
You can't... Is it sort of a weird position to be in that anything you casually say someone could take seriously and it becomes a weird headline?
Well, you know, sometimes when you do junkets and things, you feel like... you know, particularly if it's an ensemble cast, they're just waiting for you to say something really stupid because that becomes the most newsworthy thing that is going to get out there.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, sometimes you say nothing and they pump it into something really big. I've got a big beef with the internet, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know, in the time I've been working in movies and theater, you know, everyone thinks it's freedom, but, you know, it's the Wild West. And the truth is, it's great for there to be lots of opinions out there, but nobody fact checks anymore.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, the journalists are sloppy a lot of the time, really sloppy, because it's kind of like, if you don't like it, go to another site. You know, there's such fragmentation. Nobody's holding anyone to anything. And there are good things about it, but as far as, you know...
Opinion...
Or something that appears to be a fact, be very suspicious always. Yeah. I mean, everyone knows that, but you got to remind yourself over and over and over again, because sometimes I'll even read things about my friends and I'll say, wow, they really messed up, or you know, they had a weak moment, or oops. And then I check in with them and they said, no, that wasn't it at all. It's totally fabricated. So.
Well, as human beings, I feel like we are sort of designed to see a thing and go, oh, that must be real.
Yeah, but you know, so a lot of people, I think we're also trained to take our opinions from other people.
Right.
I think we aren't trained to be independent thinkers, believe it or not. And, you know, because so much is, you know, I think people like comfort and they like to feel, identify themselves with a group.
Mm-hmm.
So they run towards a certain stance, an opinion, to kind of collect themselves and know who they are.
Yeah.
So I think it's very rare. Everything, you know, in an information age, you know, I think it's very rare. You got to really fight to know how you feel.
Yeah.
It's true.
Well,
Because advertising's working on you. You're bombarded like lots of information. You know, it's just things have changed.
Well, I think I keep
that
saying...
That fight for individuality is much tougher now.
Well, how do you maintain that then?
Who says I do? It's something I'm interested in, you know? And I think it's important, particularly if you're making things and particularly if you're telling stories and you're representing a fresh point of view, because mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons to tell stories, not just to reconfirm what people know, but also to challenge conventional thought and mm-hmm. say, hey, guys, you know, I'm not telling you the way things are. I'm telling you what's really lying under the surface.
Right. Yeah. And how do you keep challenging yourself that way? Or how do you keep trying to find ways to surprise
well,
audiences?
You know, with me, I'm an actor, so it's, you know, it's funny. I'm protected by I dedicate myself to someone else's story and part of, to someone else's you know, idea or writing, and I'm a collaborator. And I usually, I'm the one that has to embody or is sent out to explore that thing, and I become the thing. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, that's how it becomes creative and personal for me. But the initial impulse comes from someplace else.
Okay.
So it's like you're always directed to kind of find out something that you don't own and then find a relationship to it. So you're not protecting anything, because it's the way there that makes your relationship to it.
Okay.
You understand?
So is it the complete release of control within yourself, or do you find that it's a hyper, like it's over?
You know what? It goes back and forth. It's never one way or the other. But the truth is, if everything, you know, operates between two poles, I mean, for an actor, the poles are, you know, totally letting go and control those other two ends, and then always, depending on what your job is and what the project is, it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. How do you gain that awareness? Do you sit and watch your work?
I don't.
You don't?
No. But we're getting pretty hypothetical. Let's talk a little bit about movies.
Sure. Well, I'm just fascinated by
that. I mean, I like that, and I get sucked into that because it's stuff that interests me. But
yeah.
I think out of context, it's hard for people to understand.
Do you, when you work with a director, are you still able, do you kind of go like, all right, I trust you if you tell me to do a thing?
No, I mean, you know, you usually, there's usually reason you trust them. I mean, that trust always has to be found. But it's really nice when you repeat, like in the case of John Carter, it was really nice to work with Andrew Stanton before.
Sure.
Like in the case of Finding Nemo, even though I was doing the voice, I got to get to know the guy.
Sure.
Because at Pixar, they work very thoroughly. And, you know, when you say, oh, he voiced that character. And, I mean, I worked on that character for a while, because
right.
You come in over time and the scripts change, and he keeps on playing with the story and plays around with different attitudes. He's all about lots of variations. Mm-hmm. And finding, approaching the scene from many different angles. So I thought, wow, this guy is kind of inexhaustibly, you know, he experiments a lot.
Yeah.
And then when I heard he was going to do this John Carter of Mars, and it was a passion project, and it was a big fantasy sci-fi thing for Disney, an adventure film, I thought, wow, this is fantastic. I mean, this is the guy that made WALL-E. I mean, yeah. Made this fantastic film out of a story about post-apocalyptic kind of
robot. I don't even know how you pitch that. I want to do a post-apocalyptic. It's just one robot. Really? Yeah. Is there? And he's just sad. Yeah. What?
And there's no talking for 45 minutes.
Oh,
no. That, you know, when you think about that, he did it. And that takes really balls, and that really, you know, takes sticking to the story and believing that out of this, you know, this very simple log line, you know, which is all, you know, he starts with the salad. You know, this beautiful story is told.
Well, that's what Pixar became. I mean, it really feels like they are able to form a relationship with the actors where they really take cues from you and what you're doing to kind of form the character as much as...
I just, you know, they've created a little utopia there where they've really found a way to balance, you know, rigor and play and commerce and art. They're really good.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm sure it's not perfect, but... they really make an atmosphere where people can help each other, criticize each other. It's a process. They understand the process of how to make things.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when that same thing was applied, because he had a lot of Pixar people with him on John Carter, when that's applied to a big picture, it's amazing how kind of, in the end, efficient it is towards making the movie. Now, don't get me wrong, this movie is a big budget movie, but when you watch it, if you know anything about how to make movies, you see it.
Yeah.
It's not bloated, and that's why I always bristle when anybody brings up the budget, because it's like, shut up, did you pay for it? You know, watch the movie. No, watch the movie. Yeah. Did you like it?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. If you didn't,
You're paying the same amount for the ticket when you walk in.
Yeah.
There's no difference.
It's true.
I like some blue collar guy like, yeah, why'd I give that movie $100 million? I should have spent that on myself.
On my family.
Shit. And it's funny, like, for people who aren't familiar with the story, it is literally like one of the oldest sci-fi stories. I mean, like, it's the Rice Burroughs. It's 100 years old, and I know they tried to make the movie for years, but I feel like it's just the technology wasn't ready until...
That's one theory. I mean, you know, and then I said that, but then, you know, I thought, oh, they haven't found the technology to integrate creatures with live-action people. Well, they did, because they did some of that in Star Wars, for example. Yeah. But, and in fact, George Lucas tips his hat to Edgar Rice Burroughs as being an important influence. Many people have.
A lot of people, yeah.
Yeah. But I suspect you are sort of right. The time was right to be able to tell something on this this kind of scope, because the beauty is, like, there are creatures in it, but the creatures are kind of treated like people, I want to say. Like my character, who is a... he's a leader of the Tharks, which is a primitive, warlike, aboriginal Martian green people, 9 feet tall, forearms. I don't know. I've lost my train of thought in describing what it is, because it's quite a mouthful. But where were we?
Well, we were just basically talking about the technology and creating this alien race. And
oh, yeah. I know what I was saying. The point that I wanted to make was, even though they're very exotic, they're kind of integrated in a way that, you know, yes, they're fabulous, but you also identify with them.
Yeah.
They're almost like there isn't a huge gap between the humans and the creatures. They're kind of operating on the same level. And maybe that comes from the fact that we, you know, Andrew was very insistent about filming the best we could what we were doing, and then animating it later. So you would find the scenes first, and then you would do what technically is required afterwards. Of course, sometimes it's made better. There are certain things that I couldn't do that they could do in post. But basically, I was wearing, you know, stilts and this gear so we could get the right spatial relationships and so we could play the scenes.
Do you, when you're playing a character that speaks another language?
Yeah. Not always, but I do speak some Thark.
Yeah, exactly. As an actor, like, how do you approach when you kind of don't really understand the words that are coming out of your mouth?
But you do, because you sit down, and first they get a linguist to make a language. They took pieces from the novel, because there are little bits, very small bits, and he, from those little pieces, imagined a language and created a kind of a syntax and, you know, gave us the sentences, told us what they meant, kind of could put certain words, you know, do a translation for us. So it's not like we were fluent in Tharp, but we knew what we were saying.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's good because, you know, it's like any time when you're performing, when you take something that takes away from you and you're experiencing something new, it kind of opens the door to thinking a new way. You know, I think that's true when you learn anything, when you learn a new job or you learn a new language or when you meet people, when you have a shift of something that's unfamiliar, it opens the door to imagine in new ways and gives you new impulses. It becomes a tool. It becomes a key. So what seems like kind of a superficial thing is great help. Like, we don't speak extensive Tharc in this language, thanks to a convention that happens about a third of the way into the movie. we start to be understood in English. But before that, the language was important to find the voice and kind of find it helped to find the character.
I think when people start listing your credits, they're ridiculously impressive. And also, I thought you were amazing in Life Aquatic.
Good.
When you a character like Life Aquatic, it's not the movie. Like Wes Anderson, it's not technically a comedy, but it is. It's entertaining. It's funny. It's humorous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you approach a character like that? Do you like doing comedy as well?
You know, you get certain indications, you know, that some things are supposed to be comic and some things are supposed to be serious. But, you know, you also get surprised sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you're not thinking comedy, comedy, comedy. You just look around you and you know, the world is made and you try to operate in that world and find out, you know, what the scenes are. And then once you apply yourself to the scene, stuff happens to you. Mm-hmm. And then it propels you to the next scene. And maybe I'm lying to myself, but right now I can honestly say, I don't say, you know, to describe it to a friend, I might say, hey, I'm doing a comedy now, something different.
Right.
But I don't really think that.
Right.
I think, oh, what's Klaus about? You know, okay, he's going to be dressed like this, and he's going to kind of talk like this, and these are his relationships, and this is what happened to him. And, you know, I think about the scenes. I think about the actions. I think, and then things occur to you. And then if they fit in that world, and if they feel right, and, you know, if people are laughing on the set, then you kind of say, hey, maybe this is comedy. But even that, you know, isn't what guides you. You know, it's, you kind of have to figure out what you're doing, and sometimes you don't even have to give it a name. I think the best performance sometimes comes pretty intuitively.
I get, and I would imagine you'd have to be pretty flexible. Even you go in with ideas, but once you're there, you're like, oh, I guess it's this, and that actor's going to do that, and then I got to, you know.
You know, you go. I, you know, it's always nice to be a little, have a little something up your sleeve, but you should be ready to abandon it immediately.
Yeah.
You know, just something up your sleeve so you put in motion, so you're not waiting. So, you know, you got to do something to even if it's wrong, you know, just to get it going.
Yeah.
And then you start reacting to what happens, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to blow this a little bit, but I liked a friend Barry Gifford was talking about, I think it was, you know, one of the great, you know, like Dashiell Hammett or someone like that, said when he got stuck writing, he just has a man come to the door with a gun. And it's totally an arbitrary thing, but it helps to push him to the next step.
Right.
And he may have to erase it, he may have to go back and change it, but sometimes you need things to just propel you forward so you aren't passively waiting there for something to happen.
Yeah.
You got to offer up something, and you got to fall on your face a little bit to make stuff happen.
Yeah, but you're still human, and I still, and sometimes I always love to find out what people do. Like, that was a perfect example of, like,
I, you know, I wish I had the right thing. I'd be so embarrassed if it was like one of the other writers, you know. But anyway.
But it's a good story, though, because I always love to know from a writing standpoint and a performer standpoint, when I hit a wall, sometimes I just don't know what to do. And then from an acting standpoint, when you hit a wall, do you have to walk away, or do you have tricks that you can kick your brain back into gear?
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
A little bit of both. Or someone helps you, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you first started acting, I know you did, you know, like you did some like street gang movies in the uh-huh. early 80s. Uh-huh. And I'd read this thing where you said you were really worried that you were going to be typecast as a villain. So what did you, do you kind of plan out the kinds of roles you want to go after to define your career as opposed to just, you know, taking whatever?
It's a mixed thing, you know. You go after roles and roles go after you, and everything is kind of conditioned by what's out there, and
yeah.
It's just a question of how much you lay back or how much you go forward with what's available to
yeah.
you. Now, at the beginning of my career, so much was, you know, conditioned by the fact that every day I was working at the theater. So movies were like the sideline, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew what I was being offered was kind of consistently kind of bad guys, which was understandable because when you're younger, and if you aren't conventionally handsome or conventionally charming or something, the strongest roles tend to be villains because they're like the young man's character roles, you know?
Okay.
Particularly like in action pictures and genre pictures. So I liked that, but I didn't want it to limit how I could be seen, how I see myself, and I didn't want me to become a sign that you show up and you say, oh, I know what he's good, you know.
Right.
It's like you're dead in the water. And you can build a career out of that. You can refine that as a thing, you know. You can build a whole persona, and some actors do beautifully like that and have a really, you know, That's one way to do a career, and that's one. I'm not a snob about that. That's just not what I like to do. Mm-hmm. I feel a little more turned on if I can live in this delusional world where I believe I'm flexible and I can do different things, you know, because in the end, that's, you know, that's what exhilarates. That's what's fun, to yeah. always have that shift of seeing with new eyes and, you know, not getting stuck, you know, yeah. not getting stuck with a certain way of thinking, which is, you know, everything conspires us to do.
Oh, it's so hard not to get superstitious or not to try to be safe,
right?
And constantly try to push yourself to scary things,
or to repeat, you know, what you see has worked in the past, and
right.
continue to work that and refine that. As I say, that's one thing, but I don't know. I maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I like a little stronger hit or something.
Well,
like
it's
that.
Good because it's a better long-term plan, and I think once you start working in one area, it's easy for your agents to book those kinds of jobs. It's easy for people to hire you.
But then you could argue
jobs.
Too, though, that with time goes on, if you have a good career that way, then you make subtle shifts. I think you'll see actors that have that in their career.
Yeah.
Was
Platoon the movie that where you kind of went, oh shit, my career is changing now?
You know what? On some level, I'm always going like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for better and for worse. No, Platoon was important. I don't want to say...
Sure.
But it's relative. It's, you know, it's kind of like, you know... Yeah, it's like to live in 9LA felt like it was a big step. Streets of Fire felt like it was a big step.
I love, you know, Streets of Fire.
They all have their reasons for being special to you.
Yeah.
I mean, from a career standpoint, you know? But if you look back now and just technically speaking, I think Platoon was important because it was a film that people felt dealt deeply for, and it was a character that, you know, people really projected on, and you kind of get the benefit of the goodness of that character.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you're the teller of the story, they project that some onto you. So he was such a romantic and beautiful character that they give you some of that.
Right.
So it was special, you know, because that was a very for some people, it was a very loved character.
Yeah. Is it odd sometimes when people come out and they go, "Oh, I loved in the movie when you were doing this and doing this," and you're kind of going, I wasn't really doing any of that. Like, people do project what they want to see.
Of course. But, you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people, you know, movies, the best movies are a living thing, you know, and even when they're crafted and they're very specific, you know, the audience finishes them.
Yeah.
It's really the audience that should do the final work. They complete them. I mean, in theory. I like that idea anyway. So, if that's what it is to them, that's what it is to them. You know, are they wrong from my point of view? I was there.
Yeah, they were.
But who cares? This isn't about who's right or wrong.
Right. Yeah. You grew up in Wisconsin, which I didn't. Or
I
you're
grew
from,
up.
Yeah. In Appleton, Wisconsin.
Appleton, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Do you ever, Wisconsin is one of those places where it totally sneaks up on you, where you never think like, "Oh, I guess I would go to Wisconsin." And you go, and you're like, "It's beautiful.
Yeah,
like,
no,
it's
no.
a really lovely part of the country."
You know, it's one thing. You know, I grew up there, and I was very happy growing up there. And then to do what I had to do, I felt like, whether it's true or not, I felt like, you know, Mecca was New York, because actors, being an actor was being in the theater to me at that point, and the theater was in New York, so that's where I ran. So, and I didn't go back for a long time, probably because all my family left. They went all over in the States. But I went back not long ago, and it was really nice. And it's really changed as well. Because one of the things that I found, you know, when I was away from there for a long time, I just remembered it as being a very white place that, you know, it was I remember it as a paper mill town where I grew up, a paper mill town where the people that owned the factories had names, you know, German and English last mm-hmm. names.
Yeah.
And the people that worked in the factories had Italian and Polish last names. and that was it, you know? And I just felt like, I don't think it was true in retrospect, but I felt like there was a narrowness there. And sure. Then when I went back, I felt like it's really, you know, it's changed like a lot of America has changed. It's a lot more multicultural. There's a lot more going on. It just didn't feel so tight, so monoculture.
Sure.
And, you know, people argue whether that's a good or bad thing. I think it's a good thing because I think the more options you have, you know, is better.
Well, you go to places like Milwaukee. I perform in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee's a great town.
It's an amazing town.
And I get a little peeved because I just did this thing for Jim Beam. And I think some people interpreted what I did in that as a diss to Milwaukee. And if anybody's in Milwaukee, I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. I love Milwaukee.
Oh, it's a great and a very like active theater culture that surprised me.
Well, I was with a small theater company there, a very homegrown kind of do-it-yourself theater company, very committed, very good, called Theater X. I was there with them when I was very young. And I hadn't been there for a while, but I really liked Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Had a lot of, I don't know about theater, but it had a lot of cultural going on and a lot of kind of an art scene and a music scene, and there were interesting people there.
Yeah, there's a lot of like performance halls, and they've done this amazing thing where they've just converted all these old factories into these really kind of cool, artistic, cool spaces. But and I always say the same thing: like, if you go there in the summer or the fall, it totally tricks you, and you're like, "Why doesn't everyone live here?" And you realize, "Oh yeah, because 9 months out of the year, you want to die
for the weather."
a little bit.
Global warming, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my. I was just in New York. It was like 60 degrees in New York last week.
It was. I mean, I was walking around today, and I said, man, it's nice, you know, I prefer New York to L.A., but this weather is really beautiful. And someone said, hey, it's 65 in New York.
Yeah, it's gorgeous there right now. I think they're probably just bracing for like, oh, what's going to happen in March? We're going to get dumped on.
You know, they say things are... I was reading an article where they said the weather patterns have changed and the animals are screwed up because they're mating at the wrong time.
So, sure.
You know, they're going to start having children that, you know, if a cold snap happens, they're going to be...
It's why animals...
They're going to be wiped out, you know?
That's why all the non-human animals should just mate like humans and just do it whenever they feel like it. Yeah. Not follow a schedule.
I don't want to go off a schedule.
If I'm going to rabbit, I'm going to take another rabbit out for drinks. We're going to get a nice hotel room.
I thought that's the way it always works.
Isn't that how it is? These rabbits are getting drunk and populating. Yeah. There's too many rabbits. We had Bryan Cranston on the podcast, who's also...
You know, I saw him last night.
He's so great.
Yeah, I don't know him well. I saw him on the set, and you know, of late, I see he's everywhere. Seems like a good guy.
He's a really good guy. And when he was on the podcast, I asked him what I was trying to draw out of him, like, oh, you know, you're a performer. You know, how did you get through insecurities, and what was your plan B? And he was just like, none of it. Was like, nah, I don't know. I was never really insecure, and I didn't have a plan B. Did you have any kind of backup, or it was just like acting forever no matter what?
No, I didn't have a plan A. That's the secret. No, in the sense that, you know, people say, and this may seem glib now, but the truth is when people say, when did you decide to be an actor? And I say, I didn't, you know. I just went from situation to situation in groups of people. I've been very lucky that way. You know, I knew I wanted to perform, but it's not like I didn't have extensive training, and I mostly trained by doing. I never decided. I always assumed, you know, like, next year I'll have to figure out what to do. Sure. Next year I'll have to figure out what to do. And then enough time passed, you know, in the beginning, mostly with very modest but great avant-garde theater company called the Wooster Group. Then after years doing films and doing the Wooster Group for, you know, over 20 years, I had to look and say, well, I guess I'm an actor, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think maybe it's interesting to hear you say that and then to see your performances and how flexible you are. I think you have a natural flexibility just in life and in your approach to your work, too.
Sounds good. I think you're wrong.
Really? You think so?
No, I mean, I don't want to give the right, wrong idea. I mean, you know, I stress about stuff, but it's not like I've never had, like, a target or, you know.
Yeah.
You talk about insecurity or darkness. That's always there.
Sure.
And It's a great motivator.
It really is. Yeah. That is a fire to light under you.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was watching a bunch of actors, you know, for one of these pre-Oscar things, and I was really struck that they said to this panel of, you know, odds-heavy possibilities for nominations. Mm-hmm. That the Hollywood Reporter organized. They said, what makes a good actor? And Christopher Plummer, who's been around for a while, said, the best actors that I've always seen have a certain kind of rage. And I found that kind of true and interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm not an actor, but I imagine, I mean...
It's there are all kinds of actors, but I think they were mostly talking about dramatic acting.
Well, there's an emotional sensitivity that I think you have to have, because you essentially have to absorb a character, and you mm-hmm. have to be able to kind of move effortlessly in between all that, mm-hmm. and you kind of have to be empathic in that way.
It's true.
So you can't not just be emotional.
It's true.
I think.
It's true. So you got to have something that makes the stakes high, and if you're pissed... the stakes are really high. Because everything you take personally.
Right. Are you able to, at the end of the day, acting, the end of the workday, just kind of brush it off? Or do you still, is it kind of hard with the emotional residue? Like, oh, I've been doing this intense stuff all day, and now I just feel kind of bad.
It depends. You know, I used to say, as a point of pride, I'm activated by the camera. You know, once that camera turns off, the character goes inside of me. But as time goes on, maybe as I get older, I'm getting more sensitive or something, but things stay with me longer, they resonate longer.
Yeah.
And if you're, particularly if you're playing like a role that 12 hours of the day, you know, if, like I did a movie called The Hunter, mm-hmm. where I'm in practically every frame of the movie, or actually another one coming out called 444.
Yeah.
Both, I work every day, and they're long days, so you basically wake up, you do whatever you do in the morning, you go off to work, you work for sometimes 12, 14, sometimes 16 hours, believe it or not. You sleep a little, and then you do it over again. So most of your waking time is doing things related to the character. So you're addressing yourself to the character's concerns. So those things start to infect your dreams, and when you're doing it, it starts to insinuate itself into how you feel. And also, you're willing this transformation.
Right.
So it does stay with you. Now, that doesn't mean you're mentally unstable, but when you're finished, it takes a little while getting out of the habit, because mm-hmm. you've got to orient yourself to different concerns. And where do you point your concentration, your thoughts, you know?
Right.
To your regular life? Well, I never know what my regular life is anyway, because I'm a little bit of a gypsy. I like to work and I move around a lot. So as I get older, it's funny. It gets a little more difficult.
Yeah.
You'd think it would be the other way around. You'd think I'd be turned into the old pro that could turn it off and on. It's becoming less so. I'm affected more deeply by things than I used to be.
With like the Oscars and, you know, like, is any of that stuff... do you just kind of go, it's just part of the business? Is it still exciting or anything? Is it weird?
Depends whether you're in the game or not. You know? I mean,
what does that feel like?
I have been in the game, and most of the time I'm not in that particular game. Or I'm, you know, I'm relatively involved in it, you know?
What does that feel like when you're sitting in that chair? And then, what is it? Can you equate it to anything?
You know, it's different, because I had two very different experiences. I was nominated two times.
Yeah.
And they were separated like 10 years or something like that. And the first time, I didn't even know when they were announcing the Oscars. My son's babysitter called me up and said, you've been nominated. And I was excited. And, you know, then, you know, you did the press for the movie, and it was exciting and was an honor. And, it was pretty overwhelming. The second time wasn't any less overwhelming, but there's more of a science put to campaigning for it, anticipating it.
Feels political.
You know, before movies are even made, they're, you know, kind of tagged Oscar material now.
Sure.
You can even read scripts sometimes and say, wow, this is Oscar bait, you know?
Right.
So I don't, and it's not just me. It's just, it's, you know, public relations and the links to the studios, to their corporate, owners.
Just the seedy underbelly that people don't want to know.
This, you know, it's much more calculated.
Right.
So it's different. It's different. And in a way, it makes it a little more intense.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if you win, a little more sweet even. Because it's a, you know, a grown-ups game. Where
sure.
Before it was kind of a more elegant, casual, you know, a nod of recognition. Now it becomes like a bare-knuckled fight see who's, who, you know, can get in the position.
I just see people just sitting in the chairs when they're like, and the nominees are, and I don't know how.
You know, they're all going, oh shit.
Yeah, exactly. Like how they're just not.
Or how I'm embarrassed.
Sure.
Or maybe they're saying, oh, I'm relieved I don't have to give that speech I couldn't quite work out in my head.
It's so hard to win with a good speech. It's so hard to win. There's such a margin for like, ah, they talked too long. They didn't thank this person. They didn't do that shit. Yeah. It just feels like, oh, it's almost too much pressure.
But I, you know, obviously you try not to think about these things.
Right.
They're part of it, but you know, that's not my job.
Yeah.
It's not my job until it becomes my job.
So where's the...
Which translates as this year I'm just promoting, you know, John Carter right now and watching with interest.
Yeah. From the sidelines. Interesting choice. I'll be back there. Yeah. I always wonder where, you know, the more successful you become, I think we all have this need to feel relevant no matter what we do.
Sure.
And you see it in comedy where young comics feel like they want to be relevant by being famous comics, but then the famous comics want their relevance from wanting the young comics to like them.
Wow.
Okay. Even though they have like this success, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So do you still, like, where do you get that with your work now?
Relevance.
Like what makes you feel like, yeah, I'm making the, you know, these are choices that I'm happy making and I feel like I'm doing, you know, relevance. Oh. Did you even think about that?
I don't. I mean, I just think about how I feel, and when I feel bad, I do something to change it. When I feel good, I keep on going, you know?
I guess that's good. You don't have to be a stand-up, then. That's good.
No. You know, I did one cool thing many years ago for the Wooster Group. We were doing a show, and as we were developing it, we decided as an exercise we wanted to learn how to do stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us were necessarily at all had, you know, a talent for this necessarily. So there was some, you know, like learning annex or something like that in New York City, you know, one of the, we all under fake names, and this was before I was making movies, or many movies anyway, so people wouldn't necessarily know me, under pseudonyms, I was Will Wharf, I remember. We registered for a comedy class, and the end of the comedy class, after we got our instruction from this comic, you know, was like one night at, I can't remember, it was an East Coast place,
sure,
but you know, like a comedy club, doing our materials.
Right.
Yeah.
How'd it go?
Well, you know, the truth is that I did the whole class, and I wrote the material, but then I got a movie, and I couldn't do the comedy thing, and I had one of the other actors didn't like his routine, so I gave him my material and he did it.
You're definitely not a stand-up.
And he bombed. And he bombed.
Because he knew it was your voice. Do you remember any of your jokes? Do you remember any of the jokes?
No, I just remember it was very biographical. I remember sometimes as a kid being very embarrassed that my mother would take late night baths and I'm not going to be able to get this together.
This is hilarious.
My mother would take late night baths, and if I had to pee or something, there was a bathroom near my room with the biggest tub.
Yeah.
And I'd knock on the door, and she'd say, yes. I said, Mom, are you in there? And she'd say, yes, just wait a moment. And it was so creepy because she was kind of like in a warm bath, and her voice was kind of honeyed and all that. And I remember I'd go in, and she'd take like three washcloths.
Yeah.
Put one over over her, let's call them privates.
Yes.
And one on each breast. And
yep.
Smiling there with that a nice, relaxed, motherly
face. You have to pee.
As I'm trying to pee. I think it scarred me for life. And I don't even remember what the joke was, but there was something about those three little washcloths being something like the pieces of pepperoni on a pepperoni pizza.
And that's why you can never eat pizza again.
Yeah. No, this is why I'm, you know, I'm not a stand-up. Yeah, when I tell a joke, I never know the important parts because it always shifts for me. I don't have the discipline to stay with knowing what the, you know, I can't keep my eye on the prize. I get swayed by embellishments, you know.
That's fine, though. I think that's where a lot of young, if you're telling me here on this podcast you're going to start your stand-up career now, I'm telling you, most young comedians start out that way and they go, I'm never going to do the same material twice. And then you realize, ah, fuck, there's actually a craft to, like, honing it down and, you know, like, finding the magic beats every time. I'd be crazy if I didn't ask you a little bit about Norman Osborn, because it is the Nerdist podcast.
Okay,
and
sure.
That was, I think what Sam Raimi figured out, and I think part of why there's such this craze for, you know, comic book-based movies now, was you put really amazing actors into an action movie, and it just comes alive. Mm-hmm. When they approached you for that, that type of superhero movie wasn't really en vogue at the time. It was a whole new thing, and it hadn't really been done that well.
It's true, but I had a sense that this was like, I don't know, this was so close to his heart, and he took it so seriously, and it was such a beautiful mixture of comedy and drama. Mm-hmm. And I liked the double role, the fact that, you know, there was this character that was kind of, is really the bulk of the character. Mm-hmm. It was much less the Green Goblin, but kind of a tragic character.
Right.
And then the Green Goblin, then I get to do all the fun, you know, action stuff that I really love to do. That's the little boy in me that likes to still, you know, do pure action sequences.
Yeah.
So I think it was just, I saw those scenes and thought it would be fun, you know, and unlike films that I usually did, I had a lot of faith in Sam. And also I remember when we started working on it, when we started going through the scenes, I remember Toby was really, really good at kind of character study, like scene analysis, something that doesn't come to me naturally. So it was really, there were good people, and it wasn't, you know, like a cynical, you know, kind of prefab tentpole thing.
Sure.
It was a very personal movie.
Yeah.
The heart of the story really spoke to Sam. And then, you know, it infects you, and you take that on as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, for example, one of the first things he did, he said, you gotta go back to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, read that. And I thought, cool, you know, that's good.
That's awesome.
That's good, yeah.
I mean, it really was. But from any kind of villain's point of view, he's never evil. He just wants what he wants, and he feels like that's the right thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody, you know, sometimes the problems with villains, how they function, is their motives are very soft, you know, so you can't relate to them. They're kind of signed, you know, they're like a force. This had that interesting kind of split that was helped a lot by the fact of his relationship, that kind of triangle of he was a better son to Toby's character, Peter Parker, than he was to his own son.
Right.
And that kind of triangle of him failing as a father but loving his son, that stuff was all in the mix.
Sure.
I like that a lot, too.
And speaking of son, there's a giant billboard of James Franco.
I know. Believe me, it's not lost on me. I mean, James.
We're right where we're recording this podcast. Literally 30 feet high, Franco. Right outside.
That's true.
Well, you've been super awesome with your time, and I don't want to take over any more of it.
Okay.
But thank you so much for having us to your hotel.
Give my best to the nerds.
I will give your best to the Do you ever go to any of the Comic Cons?
I haven't. I mean, I would.
The nerds would love you.
I would if it would make sense to me. And,
yeah.
You know, a bunch of times for Boondock Saints, which has a big, strong fan base, I've meant to go, but I've never, I've just been busy.
Sure. Or, If you ever go one time, you could go in a full costume just to walk the floor. Uh-huh. It is a human experience unlike anything else. You just can't even fathom what it's like. So someday I hope you're like, you know what? I'll just go once in costume. Yeah, okay. And then no one will know. Because if they see you, they'll swarm. They'll devour you with love and hugs.
God bless the nerds. That's all.
I have a feeling that some of our listeners are going to rip that and make a ringtone out of it. Just you say God bless the nerds. But thank you so much. Our guest today has been comedian Will Worf.
And then I went in there and she had three washcloths over her privates and her breasts. It kind of reminded me of the pepperoni on a pepperoni pizza.
See, what are you talking about? That's the guy.
I'll work on it. You won't hear from me for a while. I gotta go off to India and work on my routine.
It's like in Being John Malkovich when he takes him over and then he becomes a puppeteer.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, wow, Will Worf. All right, thanks so much, man.
All right,
good to see you.
Tell people to go see John Carter.
Please go see John Carter.
They'll love it.
For crap's sake, it looks stunning.
You know what? It's better even than it looks.
Excellent. All right, enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.